I just want to mention something for the record here. I have a very good friend who's French, and I want to say something here, okay? Now, I mean, you know, we can, you know, there's a lot of anti-French feeling, and we can make fun of France, but I want to just say this, that after Great Britain, France has fought more wars than anybody else. Of course, in the last 50 years, the U.S. and Britain would be the two that have fought the most wars, but if you look at since, in the last 200 years, if you look at all the wars that have been fought, the British have fought the most wars. France has fought the second biggest number of wars, and the U.S. is number five in the list. I've forgotten who three and four are. I took a postgraduate class at U of M in Ann Arbor, which is the best authority in the world on this. They keep a record of every single conflict since 1815, which was the end of the Napoleonic Wars. And they also record how many people died. All conflicts where over 1,000 people have died, they keep a record of all of those. And the British have fought more wars than anybody. The French, number two. But also, here's something else which I read recently. The French lost three times as many soldiers in World War I as America has lost in all its wars, going right back to colonial times. So we can, you know, we can put down the French because we think that they're not good fighters, but the fact is, you know, they've made a major contribution and have suffered a great deal throughout history. Just to digress for a moment here, Genesis 49, if you want to have a look there, it says here, Jacob says to his sons, "Gather together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel, your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength." The beginning of my strength. So the beginning of Israel's greatness was Reuben. And Reuben was the firstborn, but Reuben was not to receive the firstborn promise. The firstborn promise went to Joseph, and primarily to Ephraim, who was actually the secondborn of Joseph. And Joseph was the 11th born of Jacob, and it should have gone to the firstborn. So Reuben did receive blessings first, and was the beginning of Israel's strength. And France was actually the greatest power before Britain. And you know, we have taught through the decades that Reuben's descendants today are France. And this is a very accurate description of Reuben. "Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength." You know, under Louis XIV, around the year 1700, France was a great power and was the dominant power in the world. "The excellency of dignity and the excellency of power." You know, there was a certain way of governance and, you know, aristocratic bearing, the excellency of dignity and so on. And the French, you know, consider themselves superior to everybody else in their culture. "Unstable as water, you shall not excel." What did I say about the French? Since their revolution in 1789, they've had five different republics, meaning a different constitution, a different attempt to have a governmental system that works and lasts. But they've also had various periods of chaos that have lasted a long time. And they've had restorations of the monarchy, the Bourbons, from 1815 to 1830. And then they had Louis Philippe, who was a king from the Orléans line. And you know, then they had a second attempt at a republic, and then they had a second empire under Napoleon III. You know, just terrible instability throughout history. So, you know, certainly fulfilling this passage, "Unstable as water, you shall not excel. Because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." You know, the instability does go back, as it shows here in prophecy, you know, to the sexual sins. And France has always had a reputation for being, you know, rather a free country in the sense of morality. Now, of course, America and England have nothing to say in their defense on this one at this time. But in the past, you know, we've tended to be much stricter when it comes to morality than France has been. In fact, in Victorian England, if you committed some sort of a sexual sin, you'd go to France because the French didn't care. And I remember about 20 years ago, when Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister of Britain, one of her cabinet members, Cecil Parkinson was his name, his secretary went to the press and said she was carrying his child. He was already a respectably married man with four children. And of course, in Britain or America, something like that hits the papers and it's big news. All the tabloids have it on the front page. You can't go through a supermarket checkout line without being reminded of it. That's the way that it is. And Mrs. Thatcher at the time was in France visiting President Mitterrand. And I remember this journalist going up to her and thrusting the microphone in her face and saying, you know, what do you think about this scandal with Cecil Parkinson? And she said, well, he's been a good friend of mine for years and I'm sorry this has happened, but he's now resigned, which is the British tend to do that when they're, you know, caught out in something like that. You know, he's resigned, so it's all over with. And then he turned the mic on President Mitterrand and said, what do you think? And Mitterrand was absolutely flabbergasted. He said, I don't understand what the problem is. He said, if I was to, you know, kick somebody out of my cabinet because he had a mistress, he said, I wouldn't have a government. See? So, you know, and then when Mitterrand died, you know, right there on the front pew at the church was his wife and his mistress next to his wife. See? So, you know, there is a problem in that. And it's not just France. There's lots of other countries that are far worse. But the reason why France is singled out here is because Reuben was the firstborn and should have had the the blessing by rights. And France certainly had the beginning of these blessings. And, France was the greatest power before Britain. So if you look back at your history over the last 500 years, America's the greatest power today. Before America, it was Britain, or the British Empire. Before Britain, it was France. Before France, it was Catholic Spain, the Habsburgs, Charles V, Austria. You know, Austria and Spain were ruled by the same family, the Habsburgs. And they had a vast empire around the world. Because one day this week, we're going to look at how those nations declined and fell, and especially the British Empire, because that gives lessons on what's happening to America today. But let's just have a look for a few minutes at the United States here, because a controversy has arisen in some of the churches of God. Most people, I think we are aware, do not really understand history, and they don't know much about history. And as a nation, that gets us into trouble a great deal. Even this business in Iraq, for example, right now. We as a nation have made a number of mistakes in Iraq. And if people had studied a bit more what happened to the British when they went into Iraq in the early 1920s, we might have avoided some of those mistakes. Just one that comes to mind right away is the British made the mistake when they first took over Iraq of trying to rule it themselves, and soon learned the Iraqis didn't like that, and the British lost about 500 men before they finally recognized the need to give the Iraqis their own government. We've repeated the same thing. We've lost over 500 men, and now we recognize the Iraqis need their own government, so we've set a deadline of June 30th to give them their own government. But, you know, if we'd read up on our history, we'd know that, you know, we needed to do that at the beginning, and we could have had a government in place on the day we arrived in Baghdad. See, so, you know, when you know your history, you can avoid a lot of mistakes. And nations tend to keep on repeating the same mistakes because people are not looking at their history and they don't know their history. And with respect to our leaders, neither the President of the United States at this time nor the British Prime Minister have a grasp of history. They have their strong points in other areas, but history is not one of them. Of course, they should have advisors who know, but maybe their advisors don't either. Remember, too, Manasseh means tending to forget. That's what Manasseh means. Ephraim means fruitful, but Manasseh means tending to forget. And America as a nation is a very forgetful nation. There's a famous story told of when Henry Kissinger, the American Secretary of State, visited China in 1976. He asked Chu Enlai, who was the Chinese premier at the time, he said, what do you think of the United States? And Chu Enlai's reply was a classic. He said, it's too early to tell. You know, America's only 200 years old. It's too early to judge America. Now, of course, Americans think history began in 1776. There was nothing before that. So, you know, therefore, we forget all the lessons of history and just live very much in the present. And we're always looking forward to the future. And that is a strength in some ways, because, you know, Americans are not a negative people. They're more positive people. The British tend to be more negative, for example. But the Americans tend to be more positive and are always looking forward. But it's good also to look back and learn from the lessons of history. And there are lessons to be learned. But Manasseh means forget. And so, you know, we do put the past behind us and forget some of these lessons. Now, one of the controversies that has come up within the churches of God is over who is Manasseh and who is Ephraim. Because Americans tend to forget, a lot of people in America think that America here must be Ephraim, because it's the greatest power ever in history. Nobody has ever been like the United States. This is the thinking of a lot of people. But I want to just go through a few reasons why I believe that our understanding is correct. And our understanding is, and we have taught for decades, that Ephraim is the British Empire and Manasseh is the United States, the greatest single nation. So let's just go through some of those reasons. Now, understand, 100 years ago, it would have been ludicrous to bring up the suggestion that America was Ephraim, because 100 years ago, the British Empire was so powerful, and much more powerful than the United States was. First of all, size. The British Empire was much, much bigger than the United States. At its height, it covered one-third of the world's land surface. In 1897, which is when the British Empire was at its height, that was the year of Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee. She had had 60 years on the throne. And the celebrations for the Diamond Jubilee throughout the world, even in New York, which, of course, was not a part of the British Empire, the celebration was just supposed to be one of those greatest events in history. And there's a very good book on this that describes the whole British Empire in 1897 on the day of Victoria's Diamond Jubilee. The book is called Pax Britannica by James Morris. And he goes into how even the New York Times came out with a special gold edition to celebrate the British Empire at its height. It was 11 million square miles at that time, but it continued to expand right up until after World War I, when it reached 13.9 million square miles. And when I said earlier on the U.S. is 3.9, my figure here is 3.65, so that gives you a comparison there. So I was wrong when I said 3.9. Population, here's another reason why. Population, again, the British Empire's was higher. In the last Indian census under British rule, there were 320 million Indians. So India alone had a greater population than the U.S. does today. Plus millions in Africa, 55 million in the U.K., more in Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the Caribbean islands, the Pacific, Hong Kong, etc. In 1897, the population of the British Empire was 372 million, and it continued to grow until 1947, when the population of the British Empire was probably upwards of 550 to 600 million. The U.S. today is just under 300 million, to give you a comparison. Thirdly, the British Empire had a longer innings. The British were the greatest power for the best part of 250 years, whereas we, the United States, have been the dominant power for almost 60 years now. The British Empire was the best part of 250 years, including a century from 1815, when Napoleon was defeated, until 1914, when World War I started. So that's a 100-year period. That's the century that's known as the Pax Britannica, the British peace, when the British were the unrivaled superpower of the world for 100 years. Nobody was able to go against Britain's wishes in that time. The Russians tried in 1854, but didn't get very far. That was the Pax Britannica. Now, when you compare the United States has only been the single dominant superpower since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. Before that, America's power was restrained by the threat from the Soviet Union. So America's only been an unrivaled superpower for just over 10 years, but Britain had that for 100 years, and Britain's period of ascendancy was the best part of 250 years. Fourth point, relative power. The U.S. has greater firepower because of advances in technology, but the British had greater relative power. There was no one to rival them for a century, and their navy was the greatest in the world for almost four centuries. Fifthly, the nature of the organization. Here's another reason why I believe that we're correct. The nature of the organization. The U.S. is a federation, one country. The British Empire and Commonwealth was truly a multitude of nations, each one different from the others, each with its own form of government. The only connection between them was the crown, a loyalty to the crown. And again, you know, that brings us back to the fact that in prophecy, the multitude of nations, you know, was one of the blessings, and then the greatest single power. The multitude of nations was united by the crown. The great single power is a republic. It doesn't work the other way around, you know, if you look at it the other way around. Then investment, the next point, number six. The book that I was talking about earlier is called British Imperialism, two volumes, by P.J. Cain, C-A-I-N, and A.G. Hopkins, published in 1993. It's absolutely staggering. As I mentioned, the British not only developed all the empire, they were the greatest investors and developers of the USA in the 19th century. So after the end of, after America broke away from England, the British remained the biggest investors in the U.S. Argentina, Brazil, Chile, the Chinese and Ottoman empires in the 19th century and well into the 20th century. So you compare America, for most of America's history, America has been a deficit nation. In other words, America takes in more money than it invests around the world. We have to borrow money all the time. So there's a difference there too. Then the next point is the names. Ephraim, which means fruitful, could apply to either. Okay, so, you know, Ephraim could be used to describe either. But Manasseh, forget, is a very accurate description of the U.S. It's not an accurate description of the English. The English never forget. You know, they've still got their history around them, and people in England are very aware of what happened in, what was the most important year in English history, Nathan? I thought you'd know because you've been there. Ivan? Sorry? No.
1066?
Yeah, who said that? Oh, hey, go to the top of the class. 1066, the most important year in English history. Okay, and you see, you know, people are aware of these things and they know their history and the past. Why was it important?
That was when Norman the Conqueror conquered Harold II in England, the Battle of Hastings.
William the Conqueror, but apart from that, you were correct, yes. It was the last successful invasion of England, 1066, by the Normans from, you know, northern France. They were actually descendants of the Vikings, the Normans. They invaded England in 1066 and took control of the country, and they ruled over England. Probably only 5% of the population was Norman, maybe a bit more, that's all. And eventually they kind of got absorbed, but it did change England forever, and that was in 1066. In fact, William the Conqueror was crowned on Christmas Day. I think the Catholic Church has a thing about crowning monarchs on Christmas Day. And for a while, England came under kings who had absolute power. Before that, the English had a kind of a parliament called the Witan. And it was 1215 before they got parliament back. So for roughly 150 years, they were under the Normans. It changed the language. I mean, you'd be speaking a different language now if William had not arrived in England. Yeah, Kevin.
I don't want to sound too terribly rude, but this seems totally bloody ridiculous to say it the other way. What?
Oh, because some are claiming it's the other way, and I'm helping you to see that.
What reasons do they give? I mean, what logic can
they give? Oh, simply because they are fixated on the now. They see America as the greatest country in the world now, which it is, and they don't have any knowledge really of the British Empire. But it's an idea that has gained some followers, quite a few followers. So I'm preparing you for the fact that this might come up in literature that you might read. But I don't believe it is. I don't believe it can work the other way around. This is not a salvation issue, you understand, but. You know, to some it is important, but it doesn't work the other way around. I mean, another fact I bring out here is that in Genesis 48, verse 20, it says the multitude of nations, Ephraim, was set before Manasseh. It says in verse 20, may God bless you as Ephraim and as Manasseh. And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. Ephraim's greatness was before Manasseh, and Ephraim was also to receive the bigger birthright in the sense of, you know, greater territory and population, etc. Josh, quick question.
No, I was just going to say, we're tending to forget.
You've forgotten what you were going to say? You've just proved my point. I'm sorry?
No, that anybody that says that is tending to
Well, yes, that's true. I mean, they actually do prove, you know, what everybody thought for the last couple of hundred years, because they're forgetting how, you know, how powerful or how great the British Empire was. But let's have a look just for a few moments at a 40-year period. 40 years, you know, is of biblical significance, right? The world changed significantly between 1775 and 1815, which is a 40-year period. And it's amazing how God brought about the fulfillment of some of the prophecies. You know, we talk about World War I as the First World War. That was the term that used to be used to describe it, the war from 1914 to 1918. However, it was not the first time that a universal conflict took place. The first time a universal conflict took place was really the French and Indian Wars, although you could actually make a case for saying even when the English fought Spain, they were fighting in the Caribbean and fighting in the Pacific, so you could even say that was a world war, but you got to start somewhere. So look at the French and Indian War, which in England is called the Seven Years' War, from 1756 to 1763. And that was a conflict that was fought mostly in North America. But because Britain and France had possessions around the world, there was fighting elsewhere. The war is particularly interesting because it led to Anglo-Saxon domination of North America and was a major step toward the supremacy of the British people in world affairs. A later, longer, and more bloody war was fought between the British and the French again, the Napoleonic Wars, which resulted in a clear British victory and began 100 years of what became known as the Pax Britannica. So in the 40-year period from 1775 to 1815, you saw many significant changes. First of all, Ephraim and Manasseh were separated. Ephraim and Manasseh were separated in this 40-year period. 1775 was the beginning of the Revolutionary War, and 1776 was the Declaration of Independence. Point number two, a later war between the two nations, and still within this 40-year period, the War of 1812, contributed to two further developments. The War of 1812, in that war, the Canadians made it clear that they wanted to remain under the crown. You know, at first, Americans thought that if American troops went into Canada, the Canadians would welcome them as liberators. But that wasn't the case at all. The Canadians... somebody's smiling at the back. The Canadians, you know, put up a good fight because they still wanted to be under the crown. So this was the beginnings of the Commonwealth. The British Commonwealth nations were independent countries. Canada became an independent country in 1867. But Queen Victoria remained as Queen of Canada by the choice of the Canadian people. Just as Queen Elizabeth is Queen of Canada today. They want to be a constitutional monarchy. They want a distinct identity separate from the United States. And this was the beginning of the British Commonwealth, the beginning of the multitude of nations, because some of those countries in the multitude of nations were independent countries that still were a part of the British Empire and Commonwealth. And then also in the War of 1812, the United States fully realized it was an independent nation separate from the mother country from which it had broken away 40 years before. In other words, America asserted its independence and its right to remain as a distinct entity. Remember, the British in that war burned down the White House. I read an interesting article recently in U.S. News and World Report where the writer was asking the British if they'd come and do the same thing again. But... No, actually, this was a comment made. It wasn't against the Bush administration. It was actually a request to burn down Washington is what it was, not to burn down the White House specifically. Anyway, then the third point, Reuben, France, during this 40-year period, moved into second place, or even lower, following defeat by the British. Before this 40-year period, France was still a great power. France was in decline. It had lost the French and Indian Wars. But it was still a major threat. But by the end of the 40-year period in 1815, Britain was so much more powerful. France was really nothing. Fourthly, during this 40-year period, Britain acquired more colonists, changing the nature of the empire. Until then, it had been more of a haphazard collection of trading posts and strategic islands. Now, the American Revolution is interesting in the development of the British Empire because the loss of the American colonies led to the development of what historians call the Second Empire. For example, after Britain lost America, it was necessary for the British to find another place to send their criminals. And so they acquired Australia. So you saw the beginnings of the Second Empire. I read a really good quote recently from an Australian historian who was trying to explain to Americans the difference between Australia and America. And he said, America was founded by religious zealots who wanted to found the kingdom of God. They had nowhere to go but down. He said, Australia was founded by convicts. They had nowhere to go but up. And his point was that Americans are always agonizing over trying to create this perfect country, because at the beginning the idea was this would be a perfect country. So Americans are always worried and suffer from this angst all the time, this anxiety about the way the country is. But the Australians are just thankful that it's better than it was when it was founded by these criminals, you see. So it's interesting. And also in the American Revolution, the British learned an important lesson, a lesson in what has been called realpolitik, that you can only rule over a people with their consent, and you must rule over them in ways which the subject peoples clearly see as beneficial to themselves. Thirdly, the American Revolution is interesting because it should never have happened. There's a very good PBS series on this, and I think it's called Liberty. There are actually two series, and one was by PBS. If you find the PBS one, which is the only one I've seen, I didn't see the other one. But it brings out, all the historians interviewed said the American Revolution should never have happened. In the American Revolution, the country divided. Roughly a third were loyal to the crown, a third wanted to break from the crown, and a third couldn't spell crown. And that is usually the case in every revolution. Rhodesia, where I lived in the 70s, is the only other British colony that ever rebelled against Britain. And Rhodesia broke away from Britain in 1965. And again, roughly a third of the people were loyal, a third were disloyal, and a third were indifferent. And you'll find, that is the way that most countries divide into three like that. Even on the eve of the Battle of Yorktown, there was a documentary on A&E recently about Benedict Arnold, and it brought out that on the Battle of Yorktown, which was the final battle in the Revolutionary War, the majority of people in the American colonies were still loyal to Britain at that time on the eve of the Battle of Yorktown, because they were sick and tired of the war, and they just wanted the rebels, as they called them, to put down their arms and just accept they weren't getting anywhere, and let's have peace and live happily ever after. But then, of course, the British withdrew after that point. But let me read you some quotes here from an American historian, Gordon Wood, who wrote the book The Radicalism of the American Revolution in 1991. He's a professor of history at Brown University. The social conditions that generically are supposed to lie behind all revolutions, poverty and economic deprivation, were not present in colonial America. There should no longer be any doubt about it. The white American colonists were not an oppressed people. They had no crushing imperial chains to throw off. In fact, the colonists knew they were freer, more equal, more prosperous, and less burdened with cumbersome feudal and monarchical restraints than any other part of mankind in the 18th century. Some other paragraphs. The revolution not only changed the culture of Americans, making over their art, architecture, and iconography, but even altered their understanding of history, knowledge, and truth. You see, we have these myths that have grown up around our history. Every country does. And, so often, I've got a lot of books on the revolutionary period. I find this a very fascinating period of history. The 17th century, the 18th century, I find very interesting, and the 19th century. When I get a book on the American Revolution, if they use the word tyranny to describe British rule, I just think the book's a waste of time. I mean, because tyranny is not a word that could be used. Incompetence, yes. There were a lot of mistakes. The government in London at the time was rather corrupt. The king was interfering in politics, and he shouldn't have done, and no king has since, to the same extent. So, you know, the British made many mistakes. I can accept that, and I can accept the use of words like incompetence. But tyranny, you know, I mean, King George III was not a Pol Pot or a Stalin or a Hitler. So, you know, you've got to be careful sometimes with some of these terms. But, you know, we've kind of rewritten the history books. Anyway, look at this. Again, Gordon Wood, an American historian, because monarchy had implications of humiliation and dependency, the Anglo-American colonists could never be good monarchical subjects. But, of course, neither could their fellow Englishmen at home, 3 miles across the Atlantic. Let's keep in mind, the English cut off the king's head in 1649. So the English were quite radical, right? Okay? The English have never made good subjects of any, monarchical leader. The English are very cynical of all their leaders. And, I mean, they prefer the queen to politicians. They don't trust politicians at all. And they don't really trust anybody. That's the way the English character is. And Gordon Wood is bringing out here, the Americans were naturally rebellious, but so were the English. All Englishmen in the 18th century were known throughout the Western world for their insubordination, their insolence, their stubborn unwillingness to be governed. This is the English and the Americans now. Remember, Americans at that time were considered English. Any reputation the North American colonists had for their unruliness and contempt for authority came principally from their Englishness. Englishmen everywhere simply made poor subjects for monarchy, and they were proud of it. Since the early 17th century, the English had radically transformed their monarchy. They had executed one king and deposed another, written charters and bills of rights, regularized the meetings of their parliaments, and even created a new line of hereditary succession. Now listen to this quote. Liberty. Englishmen everywhere, of every social rank and of every political persuasion, could not celebrate it enough. No people in the history of the world had made so much of it. It would be impossible to overemphasize the degree to which 18th century Englishmen reveled in their worldwide reputation for freedom. Even the young Prince of Wales, soon to be George III, the last king of America, shared in this unmonarchical celebration of liberty. This is what he said when he was Prince of Wales. The pride, the glory of Britain, and the direct end of its constitution is political liberty. This was how Englishmen on both sides of the Atlantic saw themselves in the 18th century as the freest people in the world. Remember, this freedom all began with the Protestant Reformation and the zeal for the Bible. And it went back even to John Wycliffe, whose emphasis was on Philippians 2, verse 12. Each man works out his own salvation, you see. And this, you know, freedom had developed from that. Englishmen on both sides of the Atlantic bragged of their independence. America had a reputation for egalitarianism, but so did England. The colonists in the mid-18th century could at times be more enthusiastic monarchists than the English themselves. No metropolitan Englishman could have matched the awe felt by the Pennsylvanian Benjamin Rush when in 1768 he first saw the king's throne in London. It was as if he were, quote, on sacred ground, and he gazed for some time at the throne with emotions that I cannot describe. Certainly the colonists' excitement over the accession of George III in 1760 equaled that of Englishmen at home. William Henry Drayton of South Carolina thought that no people were ever more wrapped up in a king than were Americans in 1763. So why then, suddenly, was there this problem that led to the Revolutionary War and then, the birth of the United States of America? It's estimated that one-third of the American colonists remained loyal to England. One quarter after the war for independence, one third were rebellious, and the other third were indifferent. But America had to break away from Great Britain to fulfill the prophecy in Genesis 48, verse 17, where Manasseh was to become the greatest single nation, and Ephraim was to become a multitude of nations. But realize, if Britain had continued to rule the American colonists, The Louisiana Purchase might never have happened, and we would not have moved west. So we would never have become as big a nation as we became, because the British had treaties with the Indian tribes and also, you know, had treaties with other countries that ruled some of these other parts of what is now the United States of America. Understand, too, another point here. Joseph was to become the preeminent power in the world, and the prophecy in Genesis 49 is about Joseph. It is not just about Ephraim and Manasseh. And when it says in Genesis 49, Joseph is a fruitful bough, verse 22, a fruitful bough by a well, his branches run over the wall. This is talking about Joseph bringing economic development to the world. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. Who did I say has had the most wars in the last 200 years? Great Britain. America is number 5, but in the last 50 or 60 years, since America became number 1, America's had more wars than these other countries. America and England have basically continued the same way of, you know, ruling and determining which conflicts to get involved in. Our historical role has been to stop the spread of tyranny, which includes stopping the spread of despotic dictatorships, of people trying to establish a world-ruling empire like Hitler, the Kaiser, and Napoleon. And, you know, this has been our historical role. And, of course, it began because of the threat from Roman Catholicism. Today it extends to other things. But keep in mind, too, when you look at history, no great power can maintain its supremacy for very long. You look back at those empires in Daniel chapter 7, the Babylonian Empire had its supremacy for about 70 years. Persia, you know, for about, in fact, really only probably the same period of time, because then the Greeks started to come up, defeated the Persians in the late part of the 5th century. But the total collapse of Persia was in Alexander the Great's time. Greece did not last long at all. The Roman Empire lasted longer, but no empire lasts for a great period of time. And I'm sure when, you know, this separation of Ephraim and Manasseh took place, you know, this again is part of the fulfillment of the prophecy, because if Joseph had stayed together as one nation, Joseph's preeminence would only have lasted about 100, maybe a bit more years. You know, the Pax Britannica was 100 years. Britain was a great naval power for much longer than that. But, you know, the real height of the British Empire was that 100-year period, the Pax Britannica. And then with World War I, and especially with World War II, the British were weakened, and finally the British Empire fell. If the United States, if Manasseh had not become a separate country, with the fall of the British Empire would have come the beast power, and you know, Joseph's ascendancy would not have lasted as long as it has. But when Britain could no longer maintain its supremacy, the United States was able to take over at that point, at the end of World War II. And if that hadn't been the case, you know, we would have come under the communists at the end of World War II. We might have even come under Hitler. In fact, we would have come under Hitler, actually, because, you know, Britain needed American help in World War II. So the fact that the two were two separate powers, that Ephraim became the multitude of nations and the United States, Manasseh became the United States, has enabled Joseph to be the dominant power for two centuries, which has, of course, also enabled us to have this freedom of religion. And, you know, we have benefited greatly from that. And it's enabled God's church to preach the gospel to the world during that time. But when the beast power rises, we won't have that freedom. So you see how it was necessary for the United States to break away from Britain for various reasons. I might just mention in the last couple of minutes then, when you look at everything colored red there, the British Empire and Commonwealth, the empire were those countries that were not independent. They had their own parliaments, and you know, they had people, indigenous peoples, as well as peoples of British descent in the parliament. But the British governor, who was appointed from London, had the final say when it came to foreign policy and when it came to security matters, okay? But generally in other things, each parliament could decide whatever it wanted to itself. But as countries progressed and became more secure, they could become independent. Canada was the first one to be totally independent, and then Australia, and then New Zealand, then South Africa. They became independent countries, and those countries were called dominions, dominions of the British Empire. In fact, Canada still is the Dominion of Canada. And the word dominion was inspired, by the way, by the Psalms. I think it was Psalm 72. If you have a look there, that's where the word dominion comes from. And, you know, the Psalm 72 and verse 8, "He shall have dominion also from sea to sea." Canada is from sea to sea. Dominion also is the possession of a monarch. So the dominion of Canada is, you know, the Queen's possession, so to speak, that as, you know, a great possession there in North America. That's where the word dominion comes from. These dominions all supported Britain in World War I and World War II and in other wars as well. And they made a vital contribution in these conflicts. And it's hard for us to understand now, but if you think it through, Canada was a superpower before America, because Canada was a part of the multitude of nations. And Canada made a major contribution to Britain's war efforts in a number of conflicts. In fact, even at the end of World War II, Canada had the third greatest navy in the world after the Americans and the British. Canada, Halifax, the city of Halifax, was a great British naval base in World War I, right up until World War II. And the Canadians made a great contribution to, you know, some of the conflicts that Britain was involved in, and so did the Australians and so on. In fact, the Australians lost more people in World War II, proportionate to their population, than anybody else, including the US and Britain. And the country which did the most in World War II was the country I lived in the 1970s, Rhodesia. Contributed more to the war effort than anybody else, proportionate to its population. Josh. Well, that's an interesting question. Really, the French have become the dominant force in Canada in the last 25 years, going right back to Pierre Trudeau, who was a long-time prime minister in the 70s and early 80s. He died recently. And the reason is, really, the English voters in Canada have been divided. The English tend to be more conservative, and the conservatives in Canada have been divided into two political parties until just a few weeks ago, when they actually buried the hatchet, and they've now formed one political party. So it may be that Canada will change a little bit from now on. But the Liberal Party in France has been the dominant political party in France. The Liberals get most of their support in Quebec and Ontario. And so the French have had, you know, greater say in Canada's affairs than, you know, than the English have had for a long period of time. And of course, there's also another factor, and that is that Canada, just like the US and Britain and Australia, have had massive immigration from third world countries in the past 35, 40 years, which has altered the, you know, the percentage of people within the country that are of British or of French descent. Okay.